ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight in Hong Kong, rescuers continue the desperate search for survivors of the Tai Po fire disaster. Also, surfers may soon have to pay to tackle Fiji's best breaks, and the two dominant teams, Brisbane and North Melbourne, to clash in tomorrow's AFLW Grand Final.
It allows women and girls to become champions of the game, not just cheer on footballers. It allows them to kick a footy, take a screamer, kick a goal.
First this evening in Hong Kong, the death toll from the shocking fires that tore through seven apartment buildings is now at least 94. Hundreds of people are still unaccounted for. ABC correspondent Tim Swanston is at the scene in the Tai Po district in northern Hong Kong. Tim, what are you seeing there today as this desperate attempt to find the missing continues?
Well, there's still an enormous presence here from firefighters, search and rescue. There's hundreds of people on the ground. The exclusion zone is quite large from the actual building, so we can't get right up to see where survivors are still being pulled out, but it's still an enormous operation. Authorities have said they expect to wrap up search and rescue operations soon. They are saying that they're trying to force entry into all the units to check for people who've been killed, because there's still been calls for help, surprisingly. Even as early as this morning, there were people still calling fire and rescue, asking for assistance. They say that there are at least two dozen calls for help that remain unresolved. So people here are really hopeful that more survivors can be found. But it's quite staggering to think about, given just how severe the damage is right across these towers here at this complex. It's been an enormously difficult operation. The heat is absolutely intense inside these concrete towers. Scaffolding has been collapsing since the fire broke out about 2 days ago. So the death toll has been rising.
And Tim, what do the buildings actually look like today?
Well, it's quite staggering. Although fire crews have stopped actually spraying these buildings with water and most of the smoke has subsided, you can see enormous charred sections down the side, particularly of two towers. They're covered in a bamboo scaffolding, a fair amount of it which has survived, as well as a green mesh that is the particular focus of authorities. But you can see where it's completely burnt across these sections of mesh. So it's been just considerable and staggering, this damage across these buildings. But you can clearly see the ones that have been hit hardest by the fire, and that's generally where fire crews say the majority of the deaths have come from. So certainly what will be analysed will be exactly how it was able to spread across these seven or eight towers that make up this estate.
And Tim, what's the latest on the investigations into the cause of the blaze?
So the buildings were undergoing renovations and maintenance. That's been the case for more than a year by a firm called Prestige Construction has been carrying that out. Now, their offices were raided late yesterday, and police seized documents, employee lists, as well as computers and phones. Now, early on in this, we saw that three people were arrested, two directors and an engineering consultant from the company. They'd been arrested on suspicion of manslaughter. Now, in particular, police have honed in on the mesh that's been used around the towers. A police spokesperson late last night said that they believe that the company's responsible parties were grossly negligent, which led to this accident and caused the fire to spread so quickly and uncontrollably, resulting in major casualties. So while they haven't determined a precise cause, people here have told us that they didn't have the opportunity to escape. They said there weren't alarms, fire drills hadn't been performed since these renovations began. So there's a lot of anger and frustration. The ABC has sent questions to the company and certainly will hope to hear back, but it will take a long time for people to come to grips with this just immense tragedy here in Tai Po in the north of Hong Kong.
ABC correspondent Tim Swanston. Back in Australia, and a world-first clinical trial in New South Wales has found a common antidepressant appears to stop some men committing domestic violence. The researchers believe the drug helps reduce aggression and improve impulse control. Isabel Masali has more.
As Professor Tony Butler worked on a domestic violence study, it was the stories from victim survivors that stood out most. One explained a new approach meant the house became peaceful quiet instead of terrified quiet.
Stories from, you know, community corrections officers, for example, saying, well, you know, what have you done to this guy? He used to be very, you know, argumentative and truculent, and now he's not, you know. Similarly from, you know, magistrates as well, reported the same of people who would come to the trial. So they're just some of the good news stories that we had.
The feedback came through unsolicited emails, texts and calls, all from people associated with the trial. But now the formal results are in and published. So what was going on? Professor Butler is the study's chief investigator and is based at the University of New South Wales. Along with researchers at the University of Newcastle, he recruited more than 600 men who had two criminal convictions for violence and were deemed highly impulsive.
And very important just to state that this was a double-blind, randomised control trial. So one group got a medication called sertraline, which is a very widely used antidepressant, Zoloft, and the other group got the sugar pill and the placebo. And so the researchers, the participants, and the clinicians that looked after the men on the trial didn't know who was on which medication.
The idea was to target an offender's impulsivity and aggression, and they were supported by a team, including follow-ups with a psychiatrist. Professor Butler explains the results on reducing general violence was inconclusive.
But for domestic violence, what we found was that there was a 21% reduction in domestic violence reoffending at 24 months in the sertraline group, so the group that got the treatment over placebo. There was a 30% reduction in domestic violence reoffending in those who were more adherent to the medication, and also a 44% reduction in the rate of recurrent domestic violence at 24 months. So repeat domestic violence is quite important as well.
A few years ago, the trials faced backlash. Among the criticisms was a decision by the former Coalition New South Wales government to partially fund it while victim support services struggled. At Swinburne University, clinical and forensic psychology professor Troy McEwen was excited to see a willingness to fund a different kind of research. She wasn't involved in the study.
It's really interesting to me because so often we attribute the drivers of intimate partner and family violence to really societal factors, yeah, kind of gender inequality, patriarchal social structures, these things. And I think those things are really important.
But she says there's much less attention on the individual drivers of this behaviour.
And often when we're doing interventions with people who offend, which is, you know, kind of what I do a lot of, we're really focused on what those individual factors are and how we can help people change those factors and therefore hopefully change their behaviour. And that's really what this study suggests could be helpful.
Michael Salter is a professor of criminology at the University of New South Wales, who also wasn't involved but welcomes the results.
My reaction was really just one of relief, I have to say. It's fantastic to see an intervention in domestic violence offending that's showing a reduction in violence over time.
He urges leaders to be practical when it comes to violence prevention and hopes this study will lead to change.
We've spent a lot of money on education programs and social campaigns, and we are looking at rolling out men's behaviour change programs, but we just haven't seen the return on investment that we're looking for. If we start to include men's health interventions, if we start to look at addressing underlying depression or emotional reactivity or substance abuse, then it's really likely to increase the efficacy of all of our other efforts as well. So this isn't a silver bullet, but it's absolutely part of the equation that we've been trying to figure out for a long time.
The New South Wales Minister for the Prevention of Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, Jodie Harrison, says the government's taking a multi-pronged approach to prevent offending, but adds it's always open to reviewing new evidence and will carefully look at the trial's results.
Isabel Massali. And if you're in an abusive situation or you know someone who is, please do call 1800 RESPECT. That's 1800 737 732. If it's an emergency, call 000. In the United States, government officials have confirmed a gunman who shot two National Guard officers near the White House yesterday was an Afghan national who had worked with the American intelligence agency, the CIA, during the war in Afghanistan. 20-year-old Sarah Beckstrom died of her wounds, and her fellow National Guardsman, Andrew Wolf, is fighting for his life in hospital, according to the President, Donald Trump. The shootings have triggered a new furor over migrants in the US. Mr. Trump is blaming the Biden administration for allowing tens of thousands of Afghans who'd helped the US military into the country after the Taliban again took control in Afghanistan. The Department of Homeland Security has confirmed all asylum cases approved under Biden will be reviewed, as well as the green cards issued to citizens of 19 countries. The accused gunman, Ramanullah Lakhanwal, was granted asylum in the US earlier this year under the Trump administration. Dr. Glenn Kolomitz is an international law consultant and defence analyst. He served in Afghanistan with the Australian Defence Force's Special Operations Task Group, and I asked him what he knows about the Afghan force, reportedly called Zero Unit, that the alleged gunman Lakhanwal served with during the war.
I know that they were under the control of the Afghan National Directorate of Security, and we dealt with the NDS on a regular basis because they were both an intelligence agency and a prosecution agency. Anything under the control of the NDS is fairly sensitive, so I suspect that their role was pretty significant.
And they worked with the CIA?
Well, that's my understanding, but again, I hadn't had any direct contact with these units, but I certainly know that the NDS worked with intelligence agencies, yeah.
The New York Times is reporting that it's spoken to some of this man, Lakhanwal's friends, and they say he was quite traumatised by that work with Zero Unit. Would that come as any surprise to you?
No, not at all. We in Special Operations Task Group, we worked with our own partner force who weren't part of the NDS, but nonetheless, they were a very active partner force going out on our operations. So, look, I'm not surprised at all that this bloke and indeed any of those Afghan members of these units are traumatised. The work would have been intense, and as we've seen, the outcomes have been pretty horrendous since the fall of Kabul, certainly.
What sort of work would they have been doing, do you think?
I suspect doing human intelligence work out in the field and supporting operations, military operations, but through their intelligence partner force, which, as I understand, was the CIA. So human intelligence work is very much in the community and therefore very much exposed to, well, in this case, to the insurgents, to Taliban.
The Trump administration is now condemning the Biden government for allowing the resettlement in the US of thousands of Afghans who helped the US during the war. The CIA director, John Ratcliffe, has put out a statement saying Lakhanwal should never have been allowed to come to the US, he says, like so many others. What's your reaction to those sort of statements?
I and some colleagues helped to get many of our interpreters out and visas and their families. And we kept a close eye on what was happening in the US under their special immigration visas for Afghans. They got about 50,000 Afghans to the US, as I understand, under this SIV, the Special Immigration Visa Program. That entitled them to permanent residency, but not automatic citizenship. And indeed, there's no guarantee of automatic US citizenship. So they really are in quite a tentative position, really. There's nothing certain for any of these Afghans who are there on these SIV visas. So, you know, unlike here, where once you have permanent residency here, it's much more secure.
Could those Afghans who helped the United States, if they're deported by the Trump administration, would they face danger from the Taliban back in Afghanistan?
Well, there's a bit of an obligation on the part of the US and indeed Australia of non-refoulé, so not returning refugees to their home states, their home countries, if they face risk. But that obligation, international law obligation, again, there's no guarantee that the Trump administration would honour that. And just to answer your question directly, they would absolutely face risk in Afghanistan. Our interpreters faced risk, and we lost a few interpreters and embassy guards who we couldn't get out at the hands of the Taliban. So the work that these people were doing, as I understand it, would certainly expose them to risk at the hands of the now Taliban government.
Dr. Glenn Kolomitz is an international law consultant and defence analyst. He served in Afghanistan with the Australian Defence Force's Special Operations Task Group. Surfers wanting to catch a wave in Fiji could soon have to pay for the privilege as the government considers axing a law that ensured tourists and locals had access to the most popular beaches. The law has been controversial as it removed the rights of traditional owners over marine areas and their ability to make money from them. Liam Fox filed this report.
Have a look at the size of this wave right now. Cloudbreak is absolutely pumping.
It's become one of the world's most famous and terrifying waves. Cloudbreak in Fiji attracts the best surfers and delivers stunning photos and videos of overhead barrels racing across the reef.
Oh, drop a Pat G.
My gosh, that looks like a Mavericks wave.
And it's one of many incredible waves in the Pacific Island nation. Wayne Rabbit Bartholomew won Surfing's World Championship in 1978 and says Cloudbreak is an extraordinary wave.
Well, Cloudbreak's one of the most challenging waves on the planet. It's an open ocean reef break, you know, that's off the mainland. It really is a cloudbreak. And it's so perfect that it breaks further layers of reef that come into play as the swell gets bigger. By the time the swell arrives, it's well formed. It can get a lot of wind on the face, but on a perfect day, it's certainly got to be one of the best waves in the world.
But Fiji wasn't always a world-famous surfing destination. Until 2010, government policy meant access to its exquisite waves was only available to guests at the resorts that had rights over the area. Ian Revolvo Mula is one of Fiji's surfing pioneers.
We as locals couldn't surf and we were treated as second-class citizens in our own country. And I mean, who would like a situation that we're in where you can't even surf your own waves?
In the past, two foreign-owned resorts had exclusive access rights to many waves. But a decree in 2010 to promote Fiji as a surf destination changed that and allowed unrestricted access to any area by any person. Ian Revolvo Mula says it was a day to remember.
We lobbied and we opened the waves in 2010 and surfers from all over the world. It was historic. People flew in, people all were celebrating.
But there was still a problem. The decree prevented Fijian traditional owners from controlling access or profiting from their indigenous lands and seas. Fiji's tourism minister Bill Gavoka says that's unfair.
No one was allowed to receive any compensation. So it denied the resource owners huge opportunities to make something out of their resources.
Now, change is on the horizon. A bill is set to be tabled in Fijian Parliament this Monday, which would repeal the 2010 Surfing Areas Decree and replace it with a new framework for ownership, one that the government says will benefit the surfing area's traditional owners. Tourism Minister Bill Gavoka says the aim is to empower Indigenous communities.
It will come into Parliament next week and it will go through the normal process with the bills and it will go out to committees to hear the views of the citizenry. But fundamentally, the huge part of the equation is that when you access the marine areas, you compensate the resource owners.
How will that work? Will resource owners be able to set their own costs or set their own rates per visit? How do you think it'll work?
No, it'll be through dialogue across the board. No one will be charging anything that is out of line.
No one from the Fiji Surfing Association or the Fiji Hotels and Tourism Association wanted to comment, with both groups saying they don't have enough information and they're waiting to see the new law when it's tabled in Parliament. Ian Revolvo Mula has a foot in both camps. He's a surfer who runs a surf-related business and he has Indigenous Fijian ancestry.
Our people haven't been fairly been compensated. That's been their fishing grounds. Surfers come in, they chase away the fish, they have no fish to eat. They need to be compensated. They destroy the reefs. They need to be compensated.
Australian world champion Wayne Bartholomew says Fiji's premier surf breaks, like others around the world, have seen rapid change in a modern world.
Surfers just make surf movies and post them on Instagram. And of course, that's what's happened at Cloudbreak too. On a perfect day, it's just alive. Surfers travel, they are wave hunters. That's the nature of it. Everyone wants to get the ride the perfect wave. Every premier surf break is crowded, every single one of them. The whole world's crowded. Everyone surfs now.
That's Aussie surfing great Wayne Bartholomew. That report from Liam Fox and Diana Damjanovic. Fans of the Australian Football League's women's competition are eagerly awaiting tomorrow night's grand final clash between the Brisbane Lions and North Melbourne. It's the third year in a row these dominant teams have met in the AFLW season decider. The Kangaroos haven't lost a game since they fell to the Lions in the 2023 grand final. So can Brisbane end that streak in the year's most important game? Miwa Bloomer prepared this report.
Campbell, little tap out, road by Garner, goal!
They've achieved something that's never been done before, a 26-game winning streak.
And North Melbourne have just put themselves to this advantage of making another grand final.
North Melbourne's women's team is a juggernaut. Not only are the Roos reigning premiers, their champion player Ash Riddell has won the league's best and fairest. So, the big question is, can they be beaten? The Brisbane Lions are aiming to do just that in tomorrow's grand final.
Brisbane has thumped Carlton by 35 points.
Brisbane lost last year's grand final to North Melbourne, but the year before that, in the 2023 grand final, it beat the Kangaroos. Lions coach Craig Starcevic thinks his team is in good shape.
We've been underdogs for 10 years, so it's not new ground for us. Our group love being told they can't do stuff, so we'll see what happens in terms of their response for tomorrow. But we've got a pretty tough, resilient group that love these sort of challenges. We've been building nicely and they've been looking forward to this type of challenge.
And Brisbane captain Brianna Conan says losses earlier in the year helped make her team stronger.
Yeah, I think as Craig alluded to, like earlier this year, we've had quite a rocky start to the season. So we had to work through that and we were sort of trying to find our way and how we wanted to play. So working through that definitely helped build resilience, as hard as it was at the time. But yeah, I think just the belief in the group through that period to get through it and come out the other side stronger. I think we've improved a lot over the year. And yeah, obviously since last year and that final game, to get here again and have another opportunity is just unreal.
But the North Melbourne team is determined to turn its dominance into back-to-back premierships. That's something no side has done since the AFLW was launched in 2017. North's captain is Jasmine Garner.
I think, any team to go back-to-back is, it's massive. But, we'll prepare well today, tomorrow, and, just go into the game, ready. But, just looking forward to it.
North Melbourne coach Darren Crocker is focusing on his team's mentality going into the grand final.
We don't get too emotional about things. We don't get caught up too much in the highs and don't get too flat about the downside of things, which we haven't had too many in the last 24 months. But we keep it pretty measured and consistent.
With these two teams meeting in the grand final for the third year in a row, the excitement is building. AFL journalist Sam Lane thinks North Melbourne's momentum sets it up for yet another victory.
Yes, North Melbourne is a powerhouse. They're the record setter. Now they're on this incredible, irresistible, stupendous run.
While North Melbourne is unbeaten this year, it only just scraped into the grand final, coming from behind in the last quarter to win its preliminary final.
They did get a bit of a shock last week, a bit of a fright in the preliminary final. They haven't actually waltzed into the grand final the way that I expected them to, given they've been on this incredible winning run. But look, they've got a great coach. They have great leaders. Jasmine Garner is the captain now, but Emma Carney really set them up as a leader before then. And they're all singing from the same songbook, so they're incredible to watch. They're a powerhouse.
And Sam Lane says the first decade of the Women's League has inspired a new generation of athletes.
When the AFL launched AFLW in 2017, I think it was the greatest deliberate act of inclusion that the AFL has ever made. It allows women and girls to become champions of the game, not just cheer on footballers, not just, cut oranges and volunteer and help run footy clubs. It allows them to kick a footy, take a screamer, kick a goal.
The AFLW Grand Final begins at 7:45 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Savings Time.
The Lions won the first one. The Kangas won the second. Let's play a decider. It's third time lucky in the Grand Final.
Sounds like it'll be a good match. That report from Miwa Bloomer. Sounds like it's going to be a good match. ABC Sport will run a live blog on the website, and you can also listen to the game live on the ABC website, local radio, or on the ABC Listen app. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Sparks. Technical production by Joram Toth and David Sargent. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back on Monday. I hope you have a great weekend. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. He's called a female journalist piggy and suggested Democratic politicians be arrested and possibly executed for seditious behaviour. Sounds like a pretty normal week for Donald Trump, but is it? Today, staff writer from The Atlantic magazine, Tom Nichols, on why the president's latest outbursts are a sign he's losing control of himself. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.